Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, sponsored by EarthX, the world's largest environmental experience, and also sponsored by Natural Awakenings magazine. Live your healthiest life on a healthier planet. Now here's your host, Bernice Butler.
Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. We're here to help you explore and understand the hottest topics related to our environment and its sustainability and how they affect your health and wellness. Here, themes like climate change, plastics contamination, heat waves, and other extreme weather events and other themes will meet everyday impacts like allergies and asthma, gut health and digestive issues, cancers, lung and heart issues, and more. So listen in today as we explore climate change from the standpoint of plants and environmental illnesses. And we will interview experts in scientific research as well as the natural, health, and environmental worlds. So let's jump in. We know that plants play a critical role in our environment and in meeting our human needs. They help us and the environment in many untold ways. Plants also keep our climate stable over time by offsetting temperature and moisture fluctuations through transpiration. Plants also use carbon dioxide during their process of photosynthesis. Now, photosynthesis is the process by which green plants actually make their own food while in the presence of sunlight. And climate change also affects a number of variables that determine how much plants can grow. At the same time, extreme temperatures, a decrease in water availability, and changes to soil conditions will actually make it more difficult for plants to thrive. Overall, scientists feel that climate change is expected to stunt plant growth. And today we want to unpack that a lot more. Our guest today is Professor Bonnie Jacobs. She is professor of Roy M. Huffington Department of Earth Sciences there. Professor Jacobs holds a PhD from the University of Arizona Department of Geosciences. She specializes in plant fossil records and what it reveals about past communities, about ecosystems, and the climate. Professor Jacobs has studied fossils from Africa and North America, ranging in age from 110 million years to less than 1,000 years old. Her paleobotanical work in Kenya, Tanzania, and Ethiopia helps document the origins and evolution of Africa's modern myobiomes and has shed light on the environmental context of human family origins. So we are just so excited to have Professor Jacobs with us, and we want to start out by having her tell us exactly what paleobotany is and how it informs our lives as well as how it informs climate change.
Well, hello, and thank you very much for having me here. Well, paleobotany is the study of all plants. Any parts of plants can become fossils. So paleobotanists can study fossil pollen grains at the microscopic level, maybe even the microscopic cells of plants, all the way up to big preserved fossilized tree trunks. So all and any parts of the plant can become a fossil. And as you said a little bit ago, plants are, different species of plants are restricted in their distributions in relation to climate. So we all know, for example, that we would not find ourselves in a tropical rainforest unless the temperature was very warm and the air was very humid and there was lots of rainfall. So generally, we all know that plants are distributed according to climate. So you can use some of the parameters of where you find plants today to go back in time into the fossil record and use those plant fossils to tell you what ancient climate was like. And there are different approaches for doing this. Some are very straightforward, that is relating a living plant to a fossil plant or vice versa. And some approaches are a little bit more complicated with more statistical analyses and such. But you're basically using the modern day world to tell you about the past. And then conversely, the past can tell us something about what to expect as we move into the future, continuing to undergo this climate change that we are experiencing now and will continue to experience for many years to come.
And while we want to obviously focus on climate change, I have to think there are a lot of other very important things that the study of paleobotany can tell us.
Oh, yes, of course. So another aspect of all paleontology really is to look at the evolution of different groups, so document actually the evolution of different groups, so we have a better understanding of the evolutionary history of the things that we find living today. Of course, there are millions of species that have lived and gone, have come and gone over the many millions of years of life on Earth. And plants can also be used. Most recently, we've been using plants to tell us about atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration, which is directly relevant to understanding what's happening today. So, you know, that's an aspect of climate, but it's not climate itself. But still, plants can help us unravel that.
And I noticed in your bio, you mentioned that you helped to document the origins and evolution of Africa's modern biomes. What does that involve? What does that mean?
Right. So if you think about it, I mean, well, maybe, I don't know, maybe we don't think about it. But if one were to travel to Africa, perhaps something that might come to mind right away would be the big, beautiful mammals that you find on the African savanna. And so you might have a question as to, well, how long have they been there? How long has that savanna been there? So the savanna ecosystem that runs all across, and in some areas a little bit more in a more patchy way, Africa, that's been there for millions of years, true, probably somewhere around 10 million years. But in geologic terms, that's not really that long because flowering plants have been around for 130 million years. So the savanna biome and everything we know about it is a relatively recent phenomenon. And that's an interesting thing in and of itself. So what happened in the world? What changed in the setting that made it such that grasses became so important in the ecosystem? And along with the grasses, all those mammals that depend upon the grasses, all the grazers, and then in turn, of course, all the animals that eat the grazers and so on. So that whole ecosystem has really come to existence in the last 10 to, say, 15 million years.
Were you able to tell what it was prior to then?
That's exactly one of the things that we're looking at. So you have to remember that we have to go one fossil site at a time if we're talking about plant, what we call plant macrofossils, like leaves. So we know, for example, that it was once thought that savannas were there in East Africa by 14 million years ago. But then we worked on a site that's 12.6 million years old, and guess what? It wasn't savanna. It was forest.
Oh.
And we're working on, and we're working on other sites that preserve forest vegetation that are a little bit older. And so that work, plus the work of others using other, what we call proxies, you know, representations of environment, and other kinds of plant fossils like pollen grains, tell us that, yes, grasses were certainly becoming more important as you moved from about 15 million years ago on into about 10 million, but this was not a uniform and unidirectional kind of a change, that things worked a little bit more in a more complex way than what we used to think. So that's really what's interesting. You the more you learn, the more you understand how complex the history of the savanna ecosystem and its origins really was.
So it went from forest to savanna.
Uh-huh.
And I'm presuming that was climate events or a climate impact that caused that?
Yes, it was definitely climate related. And also you have to bring into play in East Africa the development of the big Rift Valley. I don't know if your listeners will be familiar with the Great Rift Valley. There are big valleys that run all the way from the Red Sea area all the way down through next to Lake Victoria and farther south into Malawi. It's a big rift valley. It's a structural feature, geological feature. So at the time that savannas were coming into existence, not just in Africa, but in other parts of the world as well, you also had these geologic changes that were taking place. And that may be one of the reasons why it was so complex in East Africa. You also had, you had to have had more seasonal distribution of rainfall. So savannas are adapted for life where the climate has a significant dry season.
All right.
And so that was one thing that happened. And then there's a third aspect to this story, which is really interesting. And that is that the atmospheric CO2 concentration may have changed and prompted the development of different plants with a different kind of physiology that uses carbon in a different way, much more efficiently.
So climate
again.
Many
grasses, many grasses can do that.
That is very interesting. We're going to need to go for break right now, and we will resume shortly. And I'd like to give a shout out right now to our sponsors, the first of which is EarthX. EarthX is the largest environmental experience in the world, and every April they put on their annual expo and conference in Fair Park. As well, throughout the entire year, EarthX Film does some very amazing screenings. They have what they call Movie Monday. And this month, October, on the 28th and the 29th, they are screening a film called Ghost Fleet. That's going to be at the Modern Art Museum in Fort Worth, as well as the Angelica here in Dallas. Our other sponsor is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Magazine. That is the premier green and healthy living magazine for the DFW Metroplex and North Texas communities. And this month, you want to check out the feature on biological dentist. Some really interesting information there. You know, we often don't think, but the mouth is really the window to our body. So it should be healthy and safe. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. And we are speaking with Professor Bonnie Jacobs from SMU. She is professor of Roy M. Huffington Department of Earth Sciences there. Now, as we were just speaking, you were telling us how the African savannas were once forest. That may be heartening somewhat, because that may indicate, you tell me, I'm kind of presuming, that may indicate that some of perhaps the adverse environmental features that have come about in our lifetime may change to some good ones? Or is that not realistic?
I think the way we should look at it is like this, that we will, and we are actually even now, seeing change. And by that I mean change in the distributions of plants, maybe changes in the flowering times for some species. Changes in the migration patterns will or continue to happen with birds. So life finds ways to adapt, and if a species cannot adapt, it will go extinct. This is kind of the natural way of the living world. The problem, the really big problem, is that we have over 7.5 billion people on the planet right now, and we are living through a very drastic change because the change is happening so quickly with regard to climate. So we are experiencing things even in our lifetimes that we wouldn't have expected to experience before. And so such is the same with animals and plants. So certainly some species will find this climate change detrimental. Other species will find it to be to their liking. But now we have to, go ahead.
Well, so why are things accelerating now? Why is climate change happening much faster now?
Yeah, so the main driver of climate change that we're seeing is the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, perhaps the biggest one being carbon dioxide, CO2. And we know that that CO2 is coming from the burning of fossil fuels, coal, gas, oil, because when you oxidize those things, you create CO2, and that CO2 is moving up into the atmosphere. So those fossil fuels used to be stored underground. They were sort of sequestered underground. Now we've taken them out of their space underground, and we're burning them and putting that CO2 into the atmosphere. So that's been happening at an increasing rate, actually, not a continual rate, but at an exponential rate. And greenhouse gases are called that because they interact with the radiated heat from the surface of the Earth. After the sun heats the Earth's surface, the heat radiates up, and these greenhouse gas molecules interact with the long-wave radiation, vibrate, and they cause heat to be emitted out everywhere. So the greater the concentration of greenhouse gases you have, the greater is the warming. And so that's what's happening. Why it's happening fast is because it's only been a couple hundred years now since the Industrial Revolution. And the reason we're expanding exponentially is because our population growth rate is exponential. Our use of fossil fuels is tremendous. We're going forward without managing to stop.
And I can see that that will indeed have an effect on plant life. As I mentioned earlier at the opening, I had read that some scientists believe that climate change is expected to stunt plant growth, which actually makes sense because don't plants absorb carbon dioxide and use it? But with all that's being emitted, that has to be placing a heavy load and responsibility.
Right. So what's interesting is there have been several studies that have been done looking at what do plants do with all this extra CO2. You would think that it would be like a fertilizer for plants. Well, it depends upon the species. It depends upon the growing conditions that plants are in. And so sometimes that extra boost of CO2 can be used to, say, supplement root growth in places that have low nutrient soils. And sometimes that extra CO2 isn't used for anything at all. So it does vary quite a bit over a lot of species. You have to keep in mind that there are just of flowering plants, there are about 250,000 species. Yes, it will definitely have detrimental effects for some plants. The issue is for us and for the consequences of climate change itself is that plants cannot absorb the amount of CO2. In other words, they're not offsetting the amount of CO2 that we're putting into the atmosphere. So there's a net overload, is how we can put it.
The CO2 is overwhelming the plants?
Absolutely. So the plants are not absorbing or processing that CO2 at the same rate that we're putting it into the atmosphere. A lot of that CO2 is also being dissolved in the oceans and affecting ocean chemistry, which it's a big problem.
It's a whole nother show.
Yeah, exactly.
And we will have those. But what if the brilliant scientist, one of whom is you, could come up with some super plants that perhaps had super CO2 absorption capabilities? Could they engineer something like that? What if? Talk about that.
Oh, wow. Well, first let's start with a dose of reality.
Yes.
The dose of reality is that it is true that there are efforts in different places of the world to increase the planting of those plants that can help with not just CO2, but with other environmental plants are kind of like a buffer for animals between themselves and the atmosphere. And so there is a movement towards planting a lot more trees. But I don't think we can engineer such a thing that can make up for all the CO2 that we are emitting. I mean, the volume is many gigatons per year of carbon. So So
that's wishful thinking.
It is. Yeah. I'm sorry to tell you this, but
Okay. Well, let me ask you, what do you see as probably the most profound manifestations or the most profound impacts right now and in the near future?
Well, I think this. So let's pull back a little bit on the larger scale. There will be parts of the world that will experience greater frequency of droughts, greater droughts. So, of course, that means that the distribution of plants in those areas experiencing drought will change, and it will be a big, it will have a big negative impact on those plants that are not adapted to drought. By the same token, there may be other parts of the world that experience more intense rainy seasons. Areas like that get monsoons, for example, are going to and may already be experiencing more intense monsoonal rainfall because the oceans are heating up. And that will affect plant life. In some areas, the plant life will be drowned because of too much water. In other instances, you will get more highly productive plant communities. So we have to realize that because the climate system is complex and because our Earth has a lot of different climate zones and environments for plants, the changes that are experienced are going to be different in different places. So in some places it will be very negative. In some places there may be some positive. Then again, it comes back to the people who are associated and the animals and everything else that are associated with those environments and how those are going to be affected.
And all those manifestations you just listed have obviously air quality effects as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. So, right. So it all, I was just last night at a meeting presentation by the City of Dallas with regard to their climate action plan. It's called the Community Comprehensive Environmental and Climate Action Plan for the City of Dallas. And that is a plan that they're putting together to address climate change at the level of the city. Now, our city and North Dallas in general is not in compliance with clean air regulations.
And has not been for the last 15 years.
Exactly. We've been experiencing this over and over again. And so this is not something that we want. We want to fix this. So how do we fix this? Well, one of the greatest contributors to our poor air quality is comes from emissions from transportation. And it's those emissions from transportation that are also one of the biggest culprits in adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. So we can solve more than one problem with our desire to address these climate change issues.
Which brings me,
Go ahead.
And that brings me to, because we want to begin to wrap up, what can we do now? And what are the most critical and the most impactful things that ordinary people can do every day to affect the climate and as it relates to plant life as well?
Right. Okay. So there are several things, and I know we have to wrap up and my list could go very long, but on a personal level, so things that will require energy use are things that we need to cut back on if we can, because we need to conserve our resources. We need to pay attention to things that will cause us to use more energy and emit more greenhouse gases until we can switch to being a renewable energy world, which we're not. And we're not there yet. So things like recycling contributes to that, using only LED light bulbs in your house, driving your car less if you can, carpooling if you can, buying vehicles that are more fuel efficient or even electric vehicles, buying your electricity, which we all can do, from suppliers who give you the option of buying only renewable energy. For example, I buy my electricity, it's 100% from wind power.
Let me just ask you one last thing, and then we are going to go. I see a lot of exhortation for folks to plant native plants.
Yes.
What does that do for us?
So diversity is, more diverse ecosystems are more resilient to change. And so by planting native plants you are planting plants that are, number one, adapted to this environment and also adapted to other plants in the community. If you take a foreign plant that's not native to this area and you plant it and it kind of escapes into the neighborhood and it becomes an invasive plant, it will outcompete the native plants and decrease diversity. And so we don't want to decrease diversity because then we have a community that has less resilience in the face of change.
Thank you so much, Professor Jacobs. We really appreciate your help, and we can promise we're going to have you back to talk more about paleobotany. It's very interesting, and I think a lot of people, including myself, were not aware of just how far-reaching and impactful it is. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back after the break with more Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. We're going to move on to talk about environmental-related illnesses and diseases, focusing in on electromagnetic frequencies that we're all exposed to. According to the World Health Organization, as much as 24% of global disease is caused by environmental exposures which can be averted. Well-targeted interventions can prevent much of this environmental risk, according to the World Health Organization, in a report that they issued a while back. That report further estimates that more than 33% of disease in children under the age of 5 is caused by environmental exposures. They let us know that preventing environmental risk could save as many as 4 million lives a year in children alone, mostly in developing countries. Now, that study, again, is about 7 to 10 years old, so I have to think that those numbers are even more now. Instead of 24% of global disease being caused by environmental exposures, I would think it's approaching 30% or more. And, of course, they acknowledge that an environmental illness is very hard to diagnose, that you and your doctor may not know what's causing your symptoms, so it requires some investigation. And so our guest today is going to help us unpack that. Our guest is Stephanie McCarter, MD, and Dr. McCarter is currently practicing internal medicine and environmental medicine at the Environmental Health Center of Dallas, which was founded some 40 years ago by Dr. William Ray. She has 13 years of experience in the field of environmental medicine and has built her own eco-friendly, low EMF home, working with experts in the healthy house building field. I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Ray shortly after I arrived in Dallas to begin a publication of Natural Awakenings magazine. Dr. Ray has an international reputation and was certainly a pioneer in environmental medicine. But it was interesting because I got a call the day before I was to meet with him, and I was told do not wear any deodorant, no lotions, no perfumes, nothing with smell. I said, okay, well, the meeting was in the morning, so I could deal with no deodorant. When I got there, going into his office was this big metal-type door that was sealed. And amazingly, for the first time in my life, I smelled and experienced what clean air is like. It was absolutely amazing, and I don't think I've smelled it before. But that's how deeply and strongly they walk the walk and talk the talk over at the Environmental Health Center of Dallas. And Dr. McCarter has worked with Dr. Ray for a number of years. Dr. Ray, of course, passed last summer. And Dr. McCarter was also acknowledged in his recent book. Dr. McCarter is board certified in internal medicine, and she is a member of the American College of Physicians and the Alpha Omega Alpha Medical Society. She has a very interesting quote on her bio that I love because it so mirrors what we're doing. She believes that the body is an energetically open system that is exchanging energy and materials with its surrounding environment, and it must be treated as such to achieve total wellness. She strongly believes that treatment should be of the whole body, mind, and spirit. And of course, that's a great part of the mission of Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. We want to educate, empower, and inspire you by helping you to understand that unbreakable relationship between our health, our environment, and our planet. So we are very honored and very excited to have Dr. McCarter with us. I want to start out, though, Dr. McCarter, by having you tell us a little bit about that eco-friendly, healthy house you built for you and your family.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Bernice, and thanks for making awareness of all of this. This is so important. When I actually came to Dallas, Dr. Ray, he was actually helping me with some health issues, and he said 75% of getting well is your personal environment. And by as you experienced being in that clinic, I realized he created this controlled environment with five times lower levels of pollution, and you literally, your body goes into kind of a healing mode. And that's one of the ways that we diagnose our patients is that we put them in an environment where it's very clean because your body's adapting all the time to all these pollutants and all of these different things in the environment. Now we're dealing with electromagnetics. And so he said, make yourself a sanctuary, an oasis, and that helps you better function. It helps your overall energy levels, your cognition. And so I just went to do that, and I researched with different, like you said, builders. Erica Elliott and Dr. Baker have a book out called Prescriptions for a Healthy Home. That was a wonderful resource, and I built it all chemically free. I also used Dr. Ray's books. He had written a couple books on building basically people had built houses that he recommended. He took all those different scenarios and stories and put them in a book, and it was very interesting. So when people come to my house, there's no chemicals in the insulation. There's nothing in the wood. It's tile floors, the grout, the binders, everything is chemically free. And I'll just give you an example. So when my kids have friends come or they're coming home from college, everybody sleeps for 72 hours straight.
Oh, my.
And I asked Dr. Ray, I said, why is this happening? He said, because your body goes into healing mode immediately. It frees up enzymes. It says, okay, I have all these enzymes I've been using to detox all these, pollution things in the environment, and now I have time to just deal with fixing me. Like, the body goes right into restoring health and repletion of all those enzymes. And so, sleep is a big, big part of it, too.
So it doesn't have to use its energy fighting off or fending off other things. It can just, that is amazing.
Right. And now with the electromagnetic things, 5G and all this exponential increase in electromagnetic fields, my house is literally outside of Dallas, where I go, and it's still one of the few places that is electrically, radiation free, and that is another component to it. And, when kids are in school, they're on a computer 24/7, especially in college, and when they get away from that, it's amazing. And I think that's one of the hardest things about helping people to understand, like you and I talked about, with how much the health is affected by the environment, because everyone's in an environment where they're constantly being stimulated and exposed. And I love Del Brederson. He's a doctor from UCLA that wrote this bestseller called The End of Alzheimer's. And he lectures. He's actually helped people cure of Alzheimer's. And he says the 21st century environment is so much more polluted that your body, you have to constantly work at staying healthy. I mean, there's just different modalities you have to constantly do in today's world. And unfortunately, he's pretty right.
I can see that. And I know you all see so very much in your practice there. But if you could move on, though, and tell us about what are environmentally related illnesses. What, give us some of the names of those.
Well, always think about chemical sensitivity and people who are so sensitive to different public places and they can't go here and they can't, handle perfumes. But what we're seeing is it's actually a spectrum. So we're seeing a lot of neurological problems are related to environment, cancer, of course. But
When you say a lot of neurological problems, what are some
examples?
So
ADHD, for instance.
Okay.
Hyperactivity in kids, bipolar, anxiety, depression, all of this is related to it.
And we are seeing, I'm reading that those types of things are just exponentially increasing in our population.
Right. So Dr. Lear did a study from 1990 to 2015, and there's a 300% increase in almost all the things I just mentioned.
Oh, my God.
And arrhythmias are another big thing, and reproductive problems. These are really strongly related to the pollutions and pollutants in the environment, and neurologically, neurodevelopmental problems, especially autism. And then you go along the spectrum of chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia. Those are actually environmentally induced illnesses. What happens as an internist, I can tell you, we are trained to diagnose, we are trained to treat okay, you need this medication, you need this medication, but we're not trained to look at cause. And that was what's so enlightening with Dr. Ray, is that he was a cardiovascular surgeon, and he said, okay, so we're having this huge increase in cardiovascular disease, which, again, is another environmentally related illness. Everyone says, oh, well, this is, you need this operation, or you need to get your cholesterol down. But actually, it's inflammation. It all goes back to inflammation. And where is that inflammation coming from? 9 times out of 10, it's in the environment. And it comes from the food, the water, and the air. And the unfortunate thing with our diet and our food today is it's so polluted. Unless you have organic food, and even some of the organic standards are being tweaked. You know, that's back in the day, Hippocrates said, thy food is thy medicine. And so that is critical. And so the American diet has been a real problem and full of contaminants. And, you know, now we know that we're starting to understand what glyphosate is doing. And that's in Roundup. And that's a big problem. It's just like tobacco. Everything was an argument. Well, it could be, it couldn't be harmful. And now we know it is. But it's been since the 70s, there's been studies that show, you know, that there was definitely problems with enzymes in the body, liver cancer, kidney problems. But none of it was exposed to the public.
I think even though there is a lot of denial in terms of the immediate or the impacts in our daily lives of climate change, I do feel that people are warming up a bit to the fact of unintended consequences or unintended effects.
Dr. Ray talked about mercury, because that's the thing. We started seeing so many more people full of mercury. We do a lot of tests on people to see how much mercury is in your body, how much lead, heavy metals, and it's this increase. And he said, you know, if you look at the Arctic, the U.S. Geological Society, you know, there's 1,656,000 tons of mercury. It's the highest amount of mercury in our planet, and it's melting, and it's getting into the water, it's getting into the food supply. It has for 200 years, just like what Dr. Your prior guest said, and she, you know, this has been going on secondary to industry, but now we know with this whole Arctic phenomenon that we are getting more and more of it in the water, and we're seeing it more and more in people, because it's the nature of bioaccumulation. It's just continuing to happen. So this is a big problem, because we know mercury affects neural development.
Right. And with the Arctic melting and those waters going everywhere, then we're going to see more and more impact?
Oh, for sure, and we are seeing that. And the other thing we've been seeing, which is sort of related, is that just how the water and the oceans are connected, is that a few years ago, Dr. Ray, we started seeing all these people with more cesium and thallium and radioactive components. And he said, this is happening west of the Rockies. Now it's happening all over. But he said, this is related to Fukushima. So you've got, you know, the nuclear
yes.
And things leaking into the ocean. So the ocean is critical. And now we know with the climate change, we're having more and more changes with the ocean water in itself. And this is, people think we're not connected, you know, to other parts of the world, but we are. And
it's just one earth.
Examples.
It is. We are going to go to break right now, and we will come back and find out some more amazing things from Dr. McCarter. Want to give one other shout out to our sponsors. That is EarthX, the largest environmental experience, which includes their annual expo and conference in April, as well as EarthX Film, which does the amazing movie Mondays. And this month, on the 28th and the 29th, they will be screening Ghost Fleet, which is an amazing film about Thailand's seafood industry and the unintended consequences of overfishing in that area. Our other sponsor is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Magazine. It's the green, healthy, and sustainable living authority for the DFW Metroplex and the North Texas communities. And be sure to check out this month's feature, where we highlight a number of North Texas biological dentists. And we were just talking about mercury, and that's one of the things that they can tell you a lot about as well. Okay, we're back with Dr. Stephanie McCarter from the Environmental Health Center of Dallas, which is located right across the street from Presbyterian Hospital and was founded some 40 years ago by Dr. William Ray, who was way ahead of his time, but we're so thankful that he was. Hey, Dr. McCarter.
Yes.
You were just talking about what really was one of the questions that I wanted to talk about, too, and that is, what are other health professionals seeing and saying those who don't necessarily specialize in environmental medicine, are they seeing some trends?
Yes.
Are they seeing some common things?
Well, the interesting thing is the Blue Cross Blue Shield had a study recently of millennials from 2014 to 2017, and it's interesting because they report, you know, there's this huge increase in these millennials of depression, hyperactivity, substance abuse, and we're talking like, you know, 30%. And 30% or 29% were an increase in diabetes. And so
I had heard about that, that a lot of
right,
young
so
people
were. Right,
so
that's one of the things I was going to talk about with electromagnetics is we are now knowing that electromagnetic fields definitely increase blood sugar. There's so many thousands of studies on PubMed now about the effects of electromagnetics, but for, you know, different reasons, they're not exposing this, and people are definitely affected. I don't know if listeners are aware of this, but the FCC guidelines on electromagnetic radiation exposure and limits is based on 1996 on an old cell phone, not the current ones, and it's based on a six-minute phone call with actually a mannequin head. It's not even a real person. And so they're looking at what's called thermal effects. So those are the effects that heat up the body. And we have over 250 scientists appealing year after year, and recently with 5G from 40 different countries showing that there's so many effects from non-thermal non-heating up of the body that, you know, are causing free radicals, genetic damage, you know, structural changes in the reproductive system, and now blood sugar. And we need to not move forward the way they are because this is a big problem. This can be, Dr. A told me this is going to be your tobacco. I mean, he told me that 10 years ago, and he said you're going to see agitation in young people. And that's what's interesting about the Blue Cross Blue Shield study and all these studies about oxidative stress is I don't think that the regular doctors out there are understanding the connection. And, you know, we have this increase in suicide, and we have this increase in people shooting each other, and it's all connected. If you look at the exposure and the exponential increase we're having of this wireless radiation, it's pretty clear cut.
So the medical profession recognizes the problem. They recognize this increase in these occurrences, but they do not know?
They're not educated, and I don't think they're
understanding. Are they denying? That's my question. Do they?
Some are probably denying, but if you look at the studies that are on oxidative stress and radiofrequency, that's, I think, what doctors need to see because then they understand it more. And that's the problem is I don't think that's being exposed enough. You know, another thing, I will give you an example, is in 2017, they reviewed hospitalizations of different data, and they found two large data sets that show men aged 18 to 34 and 35 to 44 have doubled in the rates of stroke. And the gentlemen, you know, men 55 to 64 have not changed, and this is compared to the 1990s. So, you know, they haven't been able to come up with a source or a cause for this except when you look at radiation and EMF. And that's what we need to educate doctors on. I just spoke at a conference in California recently. It was one of the first in the country where we had doctors from all over the world. So we're hoping to continue to increase and educate doctors on this because I have friends, you know, from medical school that had no idea that this is an issue.
Now, I've been hearing and reading about it a little, but it has not gotten the attention
that it
deserves, or and I know a lot of things take a while to catch on, but this seems to be quite serious.
One of the best websites for listeners to look at is www.ehtrust.org. It's the Environmental Health Trust. Dr. Deborah Davis has been wrote the book Disconnect. She's been around for a long time doing epidemiological studies on cancer, and it's just loaded with good information for people to understand because it's very important. Especially for children, you know, it's, if you think of a microwave oven, you know, microwaves travel faster through fluid. So we know with children, you know, they have a lot more fluid in their brain compared to you and me, and they're affected. This is called a dielectric constant. So it's like if you turn on a microwave, you're microwaving that fluid faster. Same thing with breast tissue and people, you know, kids putting their cell phone in their bra. And the other big thing they showed at this conference with all these international doctors is that reproduction is definitely affected. And so putting the phones, you know, on the in the pockets is a big no-no because we're finding with right now that the infertility is definitely increasing. And in the animal studies, it goes second and third generation. So we need to educate. And that's another thing that people don't also realize is just like tobacco had a warning, if you go under settings in your phone and you go to about and then look under legal, it says do not put this phone on your body. So this is important for listeners to hear because this is – if you could hear it, I have a meter that measures this, and when people can hear how much they are being exposed to, it kind of makes the light bulb go off. But some people, it's still, people are so addicted to it. The thing is, we can make it safe. on other countries. They're hardwiring computers in classrooms. They're hardwiring, you know, the iPads and the iPhones. And hardwiring is actually more efficient, and you don't get all that radiation.
And that's interesting. I hadn't had the privilege of having that particular conversation. Well, primarily because you don't have a lot of people or enough people out there talking about the problem to begin with, so you kind of never get to the...
Well, and that's the thing, Bernice. People don't realize that these little things on the light poles outside their house that are getting put up are cell phone towers. And then they say, well, it's such a short frequency. It's so high. It's 5 gigahertz. You know, it's not going to affect you. Well, there's tons of evidence that it is affecting us. And talking about climate, it's affecting the insects. It's affecting the bees and the birds. In fact, they're more susceptible. There's a mechanism in the cells called a calcium channel. And I wanted to mention this, too, before I forget, that the terpenes in plants are stimulated to produce more with this type of radiation, so they become more flammable. And Dr. Martin Paul has done a lot of studies on this, and he's a good resource to look up. But these calcium channels are 7 million times more sensitive to this radiation, to these higher frequencies, than other parts of the cell. And those are very high in your brain, in your heart, in your reproductive organs. These are, you know, very important, and they produce different kinds of enzymes that get stimulated. And one of them is peroxynitrite, which is bad. It's a free radical. It's not good for your body. And so what do you get? You get more inflammation again. So, you know, we just keep adding to what Dr. Ray was saying. He was very, very worried about this because he said, you know, we've got enough stuff going on in our food and our water and our air, but now we're going to add this. And he said, I'm very concerned about the future and children because, you know, medicine has been trained to, well, you need a medicine for this. Turn off these symptoms. He said, that's not going to work. He said, the cell membrane is just not going to be able to stay stable in that kind of environment.
Well, now you mentioned that the frequencies are also affecting our insect life.
Correct.
Do they affect pets, like our dogs or cats?
I believe pets are even more sensitive. And you can tell we have different things we talk about for helping people lower the electromagnetics in their house, and there's different grounding pads. Now, those are a little bit controversial. So one of the things I tell patients is if your dog or cat goes to that grounding pad, then you know it's correct because they feel it. They know when it's good. And some people will plug these grounding pads into their outlet, and if there's what's called dirty electricity, that's not going to be good for you. So they have where they sell them, and you can ground it outside. But if you turn off everything and you get your dirty electricity remediated in your house, your outlet has a ground that goes out to the earth. So it's a wonderful tool to have, but sometimes it's not done correctly. And pets know. It's really interesting. And, you know, right now pets in big cities are being heavily medicated with antidepressants. Where's that coming from?
Yeah, I had heard that. I have a couple of holistic vets that I work with, and I had heard that. Now, tell me a little bit more about the grounding pads, and then I want to hear about some of the other methods to reduce or eliminate the electromagnetic frequencies that we're all exposed to.
So Dr. Steve Sinodra is an environmental cardiologist, and he started realizing, and that's one of the other, you know, things that's gone extremely high is the incidence of arrhythmias and tachycardia. And, you know, primarily people, when they have smart meters or they have a lot of electromagnetics, if you take a meter and you go in their home, they typically have insomnia, palpitations, a big one. And he talks about, you know, he got involved with Clint Ober, who's actually a tech guy who got involved with, you know, I realized that grounding your body is helpful. And he just started thinking about it years ago. And so he started making these sheets because they have the grounding pads typically have some kind of silver or something in them that helps your body conduct to basically the ground of your outlet, and that goes to the earth. So the earth is a giant resource of electrons, and the law of physics, you know, is to go from positive to negative. So it's almost like if you think about on the ocean, you got all those negative ions, you feel good there, you feel grounded. It's the same kind of effect. The problem is it is kind of controversial because sometimes the outlets are, they're still going to have a little bit of millivolts in them, and people who are super sensitive or there's a lot of dirty electricity in their home. And unfortunately, that comes from LED lights. And I wanted to mention that because, you know, all these things we want to do for sustainable energy, we've got to start figuring out how to do it in a manner that doesn't create all this dirty electricity.
So LED lights are not good either?
They create a lot of dirty electricity, although they're now starting to make them where they have less. And dirty electricity is where you have different harmonics of signal going on your wiring. And solar is the way to go, right? But we're having all these issues with solar inverters. Solar inverters create dirty electricity through the wiring of the house, but there's ways they know they can do this where that doesn't happen. And also the inverters have a lot of electromagnetic fields. That's another part of it. Mm-hmm. And they can make the inverters much lower. So we have a ways to go on this, but those are things that are important to know, because I have an engineer, there's different biobiologists that you can contact to help you with your home, and there's a really good one. His website's EMF Analysis. He's done TED Talks. It's Jeremy Johnson, and he talks about getting calls every day in California, because in California, it's, a new home has to be built with solar.
And, oh, okay.
And so he said, you know, that have patients that will have, people will call, and they're having all these trouble sleeping suddenly, they're having headaches, they're having ears ringing, and it's the solar. And so they have to figure out a way to get the inverter away from the house and mitigate the dirty electricity.
Well, Dr. McCarter, you have been just amazing in terms of this new information that you have given us, and we really appreciate your help with this, and we know that you will be back with us often.
Fantastic. I'd love to.
And again, we are just so thankful for the Environmental Health Center Dallas and the things that you all do. And that's what Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio is about that unbreakable bond.
Yes.
And so we, again, appreciate you very much for being here. Our guest has been Dr. Stephanie McCarter with the Environmental Health Center Dallas. Thank you so much. The conversation starts here, but our strongest desire is for it to continue in your home, in your social circles, in your workplaces, and at the water cooler, so that we can all work together to realize that healthy living is simply not possible without a healthy planet. Thank you for joining us today.